to the Creative Pen Podcasts. I'm Joanna Penn, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options, internet sales and promotion for your book. The companion website is www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm interviewing J. Daniel Sawyer. Dan is the author of 9 science fiction, fantasy and mystery novels, as well as a podcaster, media producer and philosopher and polymath. Dan's latest book is the brilliant Throwing Lead, A Writer's Guide to Firearms and Their Uses, which we're focusing on today, and I'm personally very excited about. And just so everyone knows, we will not be discussing politics. We're just going to be looking at the useful aspects of writing about guns, which are so important. So welcome, Dan.
Howdy.
It's great to have you back on the show with such
an, fun to be on.
Yeah, an exciting book. So I think we've got to start, you know, because I'm in Britain, as we just said, and we're not allowed guns. And of course, there's the stereotype of the sort of gun-toting American. So why the book and why you?
About a year and a half ago, Philippa Ballantyne was in town, and being from New Zealand, where guns are allowed, but they're not common, she had never really gone shooting, and she was in the middle of writing her Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences book, which is takes place in London in the 19th century and has lots of shoot 'em up scenes. And we got to talking, and she's like, you know, I've never fired one. I don't really know what it's like. And so I took her down to the range, and over the course of 2 hours, I gave her sort of a full course from basic safety all the way through to concealment techniques and different stuff like that. And within about the next month, 4 other authors pinged me asking me the same kinds of questions she was. Now, I grew up, both of my grandfathers are cattle ranchers, and quite a number of my family had been in the military, so I grew up with guns as sort of a background fact of life. It wasn't a political thing. They were just, you know, like some people own motorcycles, some people own guns. It was like that. And I got my first BB gun when I was 4 years old and was promptly, very sternly taught safety when I was discovered shooting it in a very unsafe manner. And it hadn't occurred to me that with over the last generation or so, most people in the world are now growing up in cities. And so their only contact with guns comes through either through TV or through being mugged or through seeing a police officer carrying one. And you don't really get a good picture of how they work and what owning and carrying one does to the way you think about the world and all the subtle aspects of the way violence works that you pick up by osmosis just being around people who have at one time or another had to use weapons professionally. And so I started working on a podcast, and I ran it through a friend of mine who at one point was in a biker gang and then at a later point was on the cop side of the law. And she said, oh, this is great, but you forgot this thing and this thing and this thing. And we started talking, and it turned from a podcast project into a book project, and she came on as my co-author. And over the course of writing the book, it became more and more apparent to us that there really is a market for this. Writers, by and large, grow up in cities, work on computers, don't shoot a lot of guns. So we figured, hey.
Yeah, let's do it. And yes, we were just talking before the recording there about how I went to a range and took my husband for our anniversary, which he was very excited about. And we shot, you know, revolvers and handguns and rifles and I don't even know all the words, shotguns. And it was great fun. But you're right. I mean, it was a very different experience. And obviously, it's nothing like actually being someone who uses one regularly. So why don't we go straight into it and sure. Tell us the top 3, and the book is massive and it's full of information.
Yeah, we have about 95,000 words and quite a few pictures.
Yeah, I mean, it is very comprehensive book. But what are some of the top things that people get wrong when they're writing about guns?
Ooh, I would say the one that really gets me, the two that really gets me are the basic confusion between a revolver and a pistol. Authors who've never been around guns will call a revolver a pistol, and though technically, because it's a handgun, it's lexically correct, no shooter in the world talks that way. you have revolvers, and then you have semi-automatics, and the semi-automatics are called pistols by people who use them, and revolvers are called revolvers by people who use them. And then a related confusion is, while with a revolver you can continue pulling the trigger and have it click for a dramatic moment. They're out of ammo and they keep pulling the trigger and it clicks. That doesn't happen with an automatic.
Yeah.
And I will show you why.
Ooh, exciting!
This is a 1911 model Colt 45, or that family of weapon. The slide locks back to load the weapon. And when, you know, when you fire it, it slides back, it pushes another, here's the breech here, pushes another another round forward from the top of the magazine. When the top of the magazine is empty, like this one is, and the slide comes back, it locks. You can't pull the trigger.
You can't fire it.
So, and the person on the other end of the weapon knows you're empty. It kind of shows. This, as opposed to this, or from the point of view, this is what it looks like when the slide is not locked back, and this is what it looks like when it is. You can tell the difference. And yet people will use that in books and in movies as a dramatic technique, and the only time that ever works is if the gun has gone empty, the shooter has not reloaded it, they've released the slide and holstered it, and then later drawn it, forgetting that they ever had run out of ammo, which... No shooter, no combat shooter ever would. A combat shooter fires fires a bullet, and they mentally count down. You've got the capacity of your gun plus or your magazine plus the barrel. If see in this weapon, it's 7. So I fire one mentally. I've got a counter at 6 in my head, and then at 5 and 4 and 3, and then at 1, I would swap magazines so it would never lock back anyway.
Wow. Okay, so that's one thing, and I can see people get that wrong all the time, and in fact,
yeah,
as you say, as the shooter, you would know about those bullets.
Yeah, and if you've never shot, or if you've never been trained in basic combat shooting, that sort of thing wouldn't occur to you to think about to put in your book, but chances are a good number of your readers will have done so, because they'll have been in the military, even if they're in England, where you're not allowed to own or use weapons privately, you still have a good number of the men will cycle through their national service in the military as opposed to in other areas. So they'll be able to tell, and it will throw them out of the story.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so that's one. What's another one?
Shotguns don't fire bullets unless you've deliberately put one in there. Shotguns fire sprays of little pellets, and that makes using a shotgun completely different from using a rifle, both tactically and in the kind of damage it does to somebody. People firing guns in highly populated areas and missing a lot. Criminals might do that. Criminals are stupid. They have their own rules. But cops don't do that. or people doing that in the heat of the in the heat of the moment, or in the heat of stupidity, and the bullet never hitting someone on the other side of the wall, or firing a gun upwards and the bullet never hits anybody. That kind of stuff. You know, there's a one of these 45 round is weighs about, I would say, I don't have the weight on me right now, but it's a hefty little thing, weighs a few grams at least. And it's got enough powder behind it, this is a very low-powered round, but very big diameter, to travel about a mile or a half a mile before it falls to the ground. And it will go through pretty much anything between here and there, unless it goes through dense foam or it bounces off in fragments on a brick wall or something. You can't protect yourself from a swarm of bullets by hiding behind a table. The only thing you can do is make the bad guy have to shoot more bullets so that, because there's a wider table than you are, so you'd shoot all the way across, right? But he's eventually going to find you. All sorts of stuff like that. Movie physics work on the Walt Disney principle of the plausible impossible. it doesn't, like, and it's what you see in cartoons, when a duck gets squashed by a 16-ton weight and comes out from underneath stretching like an accordion, your brain buys it even though you know it's not true. The duck would actually be a bloody mess of feathers and bones and meat. Mm. It would be very unsavory once you lifted that weight up. Mm. The way action scenes work in movies tend to work on the same principles. It's cartoon physics rather than real physics, mm. which is fine if you're doing fiction that has that cartoony quality about it. But if you're trying to do a realistic thriller, you want the gunplay to be much more realistic.
Mm. So if somebody is shot then, because our heroes and heroines often get kind of shot and then they mm-hmm. often walk off, you know, limping a bit. What's more realistic?
Oh, if you get hit in the torso, chances are you're going to be dead, or at least really seriously in need of a hospital. When a bullet hits the body, you get two kinds of damage. You get the actual puncture wound, which is the same as you'd get with an arrow. And then you get the hydrostatic shock, which is the shockwave. Like if you were to punch a blob of gelatin with your hands and you see it ripple out like that, that goes through all your organs. And that pushes all the fluids, the bile and the feces and the blood and the lymph and everything, pushes them out that hole that the bullet has just made and flood into other organs. So you can get sepsis. You can get really nasty diseases very quickly because the fluids from your organs are intermingling. And you can bleed to death internally if you get hit anywhere in the torso. You doesn't mean you will. There are quite, you know, people quite often will get hit and will get lucky. It'll bounce off a rib or happen to go through an area of the body cavity that doesn't have a lot of really sensitive organs, but that's luck of the draw stuff. Mm. If you get hit in the shoulder and the leg, you risk rupturing one of the major arteries and bleeding to death in a minute or two. However, if you get hit in the ass, you'll have trouble walking, but it won't really hurt you because
okay.
there's no major blood supply back there. Shins are another good place to get hit because there's no blood supply in the shins. Mm. When you want your hero to reliably shoot someone where they are not going to get killed, you would have him go skip shot shotgun off the ground to the shins or shoot someone in the butt or something like that. But they wouldn't go and shoot for the kneecap or the shoulder intending to do non-lethal damage. They might do that in a pinch if they've got no other shot and they don't want to definitely kill somebody. Mm. But a professional shooter will, you know, they take, when you draw the gun, you accept responsibility for killing someone. Doesn't mean you will if you can avoid it, but you accept responsibility for it. And you don't bring it out unless you're at that point where someone has to die in order to assure the security or safety of someone else. So that mindset shift makes a difference in how shooters behave in situations that often gets missed by writers.
Yeah, so I'm really interested in that because, yeah, the bullet stuff's probably a bit gruesome for my podcast.
Sorry about that.
No, it's fascinating. And, you know, I'm one of those A-team violence writers myself. I don't want horror. I want more A-team violence. So let's talk about the psychology, which is interesting. So you mentioned it at the beginning. How do you feel when you are someone who knows guns? Does it give you more confidence? How do you act?
It depends on the kind of shooter you are. If you're a target shooter, the violent parts of that are associated with weapons tend to recede to the back of your mind. You're aware of them, but you don't think about them because your interaction with the weapon is primarily as a dangerous toy in a specialized environment. You're aware that they're very dangerous, and you treat them with very great respect, but when you pull it out of its holster and aim it downrange, you're not thinking, wow, if that was a person, they'd be f***ed right now. Whereas if, or it, feel free to bleep that.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas if you're a cop or in the army, that awareness is much closer to the forefront of your mind. Or if you've ever been in a situation where you have had to shoot someone in self-defense or where you were convinced you were going to have to and were saved at the last minute. I had that experience once. I was, you know, 2 seconds from shooting someone in self-defense and the cops showed up. So I didn't have to shoot anyone, but I had to go across that bridge in my head where you because when you do that, when you shoot someone else, you have to make a value judgment that that person's life is less important than mine, or less important than the person that I'm protecting. And that's not an easy bridge to cross mentally when you're in an egalitarian society where all men are created equal and all people are created equal. When that's the core of your value system, it's very hard to then go and with all seriousness say, I deserve to live more than you do. Mm-hmm. And that colors the way that you see the world, at least when the guns are in play. Now, if you do that kind of a job for long enough, it colors the way you see the world permanently. Which is one of the reasons why, say, cops and veterans have so much trouble forming stable marriages and stable relationships, because there's that core of themselves that they instinctively want to protect civilians from. Mm. They know themselves to be capable of things that they don't want to be capable of. They see the world in more strategic terms that their partner doesn't. And they like that innocence in their partner, and they wish they could have it back, and so they don't want to share it. But that creates a barrier to intimacy. If they're lucky enough to have married another veteran or another cop, then the relationship dynamics are different, because they share that that core tactical awareness of the world. But on the other hand, they don't have a proxy by which to reclaim their lost innocence. Mm. So they have to find other ways to do that. So you get all sorts of fun character dynamics you can work with.
Mm. And when you, I mean, you said you were in that situation and obviously you're experienced with guns. And when we're writing about this, so our character, does time slow down? Is there, you know, what actually happens?
So, it's the, if you've ever been in a car crash, it's the same thing that happens when you're in a car crash. You're, as the adrenaline kicks up, the blood supply to your peripheral nervous system gets starved. Your brain is sucking up all the blood so it has maximum processing power. Because of that, your fine motor control goes. Now, the way this happens is different for men and women. They have different physiological curves. Women take a longer time to ramp up, but they stay at the peak of this condition for a longer time, whereas men go up and down from it real quickly. As the arousal builds, your fine motor control goes. So things like flicking open a knife become impossible. If you've ever been in a situation where you thought you were being followed through a parking lot and you're fumbling for your keys to get into the car so you're safe, mm-hmm. The reason you're fumbling for your keys is your fingers don't have the blood supply to work properly. So where you would normally reach into your pocket and come out with your key in the right hand, suddenly nothing works right. Mm. Same thing happens when you're in a gunfight. So things like, for example, aiming well become very difficult because aiming is a fine motor control activity. You have a very heavy piece of metal at the end of your arm and you're doing this. Mm. That becomes really difficult, which is why people in the police and the military train with distraction so that they build the habit of draw, aim, fire on target into their autonomic nervous system under pressure so that when they hit that adrenaline curve, their body takes over and they don't have to think about it. Mm. Your vision will narrow. You'll start to lose your peripheral vision. You get hyper-focused on details. And if you're not looking at the right detail, you can get screwed. You or the person at the other end of the weapon can get screwed. There was a shooting in Chicago a few years ago. 9 cops shot this poor guy in his doorway who was getting his keys out because they had been following one criminal and sort of staking him out and following him around town, and they knew he was carrying a weapon. And somewhere in the stakeout, they got mixed up with this guy that looked a lot like him that was walking home.
No.
And they got all the way to his home, and he went into a different house than they thought he was going into, so they thought he was breaking in. So they got out of the car, they come up to the porch, all their weapons drawn, and they say, stop, drop your weapon, and he's got his keys in his hand. And he turns around to say, I'm not carrying anything. And before he gets the sentence finished, he's dead on the ground. Because all of them were watching his hands. They literally could not hear what he was saying. Mm. He turns around in the dark. He's carrying something. They're already convinced he's a criminal with a weapon. They all fire before they realize what's going on. Mm. That kind of thing is tragic, and it happens because of the way that our brain sucks up all the blood and hyper-focuses in an emergency. Mm. So time slows down, and reaction speeds up, but your awareness of what you're doing also goes away. You go on to autopilot. If you're not trained to handle that, you tend to either run for cover real quick or freeze. And when you freeze, because people freeze, that's why you can get massacres where one guy, like at Columbine, or two guys, walk through the halls with very simple weapons and can just kill people, you know, until they run out of ammunition because no one does anything. No one does anything because they're frozen with terror. We live in a very, very safe world. Mm. So, you know, it's not like we're on the savannah anymore. We have to deal with tigers, right? We're not used to experiencing terror every day. So we don't know how to handle it when it hits. So unless you train to handle terror, when it hits, you don't know whether you're someone who freezes or someone who runs or someone who fights back. And not having trained to deal with whatever your natural reaction is, you tend to be a sitting duck. Mm. So in a situation where you've got a civilian who's under fire from a criminal, and they suddenly turn all badass because they've had karate class, it never happens. Never happens in real life.
Yeah.
If they've had combat training, that's different. Because what combat training does is it simulates the danger in a way that gets you used to gradually ramping your adrenaline system up so that you become habituated to operating at that high level of arousal. Mm. But you don't get that in a standard martial arts or self-defense class or anything like that.
Yeah, no. This is so interesting. one of the things that I was wondering as well, okay, so if we have characters who are shooting, which many of us are, we have to choose a gun for yes. our character. So my protagonist, Morgan Sierra, gets a Barak SP-21 pistol, which was the one I found on the internet for the Israeli Defense Force.
Right, and your protagonist used to be in the Israeli Defense Force.
Exactly. Right? So yeah. I figured, well, you know, she could have got one and brought it into England secretly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, did I get that wrong? And what should other people...
No, that's actually a really good way to do it. Mm. So people tend to fall in love with their first gun, or at least the first one that fits. The ergonomics are different, so it can take a while to find one that fits your hand comfortably, where the recoil works well with the way your body likes to bend and all that stuff. The reason that I have this 45 that I showed you earlier is that the flat back and the heavy front direct the recoil straight back at me, and it fits my hand. And I prefer that because I can get back on target for a second shot faster. As opposed to the European 9mm, they tend to have the curved backs, so the front snaps up quite a lot. I don't like that. Some people really do. It helps give them a mental breather between shots. I like finishing the magazine and putting it down rather than, you know, having to bring it down every time. It's individual emotional reaction, and people who shoot tend to be very monogamous. Even collectors, you know, there are people who collect weapons because they just love them, and they'll have 30, 40 weapons on a wall in their safe. But the first one that they learned to shoot with and that they fell in love with, that's the one that they keep loaded by their bedside. Mm. Or that's the one that they carry if they've got a carry permit or whatever. That's the one that they'll go out in the backyard and shoot with if they've got a big backyard, where the others they'll just keep locked up for when friends come over. Mm. So if someone is coming up in the Army, in the U.S. Army in the era of World War II, they'll shoot a 45 for life. If they're coming up in the U.S. Army in the 1990s, they're going to love the Beretta 92. Is the little 9mm pistol you see in all the movies. Mm. So that your character was in the Israeli Defense Forces when she learned to shoot, and then she carries that weapon going forward, is absolutely perfectly realistic.
Yay!
However, if she was a civilian from Israel,
yeah,
knowing what her age is, I don't think it would be realistic because she would be too young to have encountered that gun in civilian use. Mm. at the time when she was learning to shoot and carry. In that case, I would have said you need something 5 or 10 years older so that it had time to penetrate the market.
That's a good point. Okay, so people can do their research on the internet, but they have to think about, what about size as well for women's hands versus men?
Yeah, size is a huge issue because the bones in your wrist can only take so much of a beating. And every time you fire a gun, it's pushing back at you with the same force that the bullet is going forward. So over the course of 100, 200 rounds in a target session, you get really tired hands. If your main character is roughly the same size as you are, it's really easy because you just go to a target range. If you're in England, you take the train through the tunnel and go to a target range in France or Belgium or Norway. Go to a target range, rent a few weapons, and find one that works really well for you, and that'll work well for your character. If you're getting tired to the point of exhaustion after 100 rounds, it's the gun's too big. It's either too heavy as the gun or you're shooting too high a caliber, too powerful a load. Generally speaking, if your wrist is less than 7 inches around, you're going to want a 38 special or 9mm, which is virtually the same thing, or a weaker load in terms of what's comfortable to carry. And if it's more than 7 inches, 38 special or larger. You then have to balance that out with what's the weapon going to be used for. If it's going in a garter, you're not going to want a 357 Magnum. You're going to have to use a little Derringer. Whereas, you know, if it's going to be worn in a holster outside versus concealed on the person, you have different form factor requirements for the gun itself. If you're going after humans versus rabbits, you know, you can go after rabbits with a 22. With humans, you need at least a 9mm. And if you're going into bear country, yeah, and you carry a 22, the bears call you lunch.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're carrying a 44 or a short-barreled shotgun with slugs in it, you're going to be fine. By the way, if you have characters going into bear country and they're not armed, they're stupid.
Yeah. Right. Well, there is so much I want to ask you, but the book is massive. It's like, you know, the Bible of writers and guns. So maybe you could just tell us a bit about what's in the book so people know what to look for.
Oh, let's see. We talk about basic safety practices, that the kind of stuff that every shooter absorbs. Well, it's taught formally, but absorbs through osmosis and does automatically. There's stuff you see on TV all the time with actors handling guns in a way that no shooter would ever do. So we've got a chapter on safety that explains all that stuff. We've got two chapters that deal with the entire history of the evolution of firearms and all the terminology, not just associated with guns, but that's infiltrated our language because of guns. For example, if you have someone in the Roman era telling their troops to fire their arrows, or they actually did that in Lord of the Rings, and I was like, or in the movies, and I was like, oh God, because firing comes from setting fire to the gunpowder with a matchlock to propel your weapon. Before that, with arrows, you said loose because you were letting it go. We talk about ammunition, how it's put together, what a caliber is, what it means, how to tell what is a powerful bullet versus a not powerful bullet. We talk about the tactics and psychology of home defense in a chapter called A Naked Woman Fully Dressed, which is is based on a hysterical story that happened to a friend of mine. Ballistics and forensics, basically how things like ballistics analysis works and how crime labs work and why only criminals get caught by these things, because criminals are stupid, because they're very easy to fool. So we talk about how they're fooled and how they can be pulled off track by a clever criminal, and then what their countermeasures are for that. We talk about the physiological effects of bullets, how different kinds of bullet wounds hurt people and kill people or fail to, what safe wounding is, which we talked about a little here. We've got three chapters on handguns, carrying them concealed, how police conduct pat downs and spot who's carrying a weapon from across the room and how clever criminals can use those tactics against police to get by scanners or by the Secret Service, and then how, yeah, and how the arms race between the two groups advances as time goes on and sophistication goes up. We've got two chapters on long guns, rifles and shotguns, and what makes them different from each other and how they're used and when they're used and what the psychology of snipers is. We've got a chapter on science fiction weaponry, everything from portable plasma guns to laser guns to massive rail guns shot off of spaceships, and what the real world physics are and where people in popular media bend them in order to tell a good story point. And we use examples from our own books of where we've made conscious trade-offs between reality and drama and how we've weighted them, just in case it helps other writers. Chapters on marksmanship, drills that people who shoot a lot perform in order to stay on bead, how you clean and maintain a weapon, how silencers work and what they don't do despite what you see in movies, how body armor works and what it doesn't stop despite what you see in movies, small artillery, shooters' day-to-day habits, the psychology that different warrior cultures and hunters and groups of killers develop over time. And then a basic recap on terminology and all that stuff. We go through the whole gamut of small arms. And then there will eventually, of course, be Throwing Lead 2, which deals with group tactics, hostage situations, and explosives.
Cool.
Yeah.
You must be loving this. Is this like really fun?
It's fun. It's a lot compared to writing novels. This is hard work, but it is a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you know, I need to go back and read it again. It is huge, but I highly recommend it to anyone who wants to use guns in their books, and that's a lot of people. So where can people find it?
Oh, and we've organized it so that you can read it through once and then be able to go back and find stuff as you need them in your writing. Where can you find it? You can find it at Smashwords. You can find it at Barnes & Noble. You can find it at Amazon. It's $9.99. It hasn't yet gone out to Smashwords expanded distribution channels, but it should do in the next month or so. And in another couple of months, there will be a paperback, which will be out for $25.99, I think, is what we're going to set, or $24.99 or something like that. So, yeah.
Fantastic. And where can people find you?
You can find me and everything I do at www.jdsawyer.net.
Fantastic. Well, thanks ever so much for your time, Dan. That was brilliant.
Thank you, Joanna. It's been fun. We must do this again.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You can get more information on writing, publishing options, sales, and promotion for your book at www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with double N. And you can also get your free How to Be an Author workbook at www.howtobeanauthor.com. See you next time!